My name is Matthew Arrett. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review and the director of the Rising Tide Foundation. I've written a few books as well on the untold history of Canada. I'm based in Montreal, or very close to Montreal. And so I've been doing this now for about, I would say, about 20 years, as far as an obsession is concerned, to try to just, in a certain sense, help my own mind make sense of the chaos that I was born into and the neurotic dysfunctions of our society that I was told and we were all told were normal and that we should adapt to. And you kind of know that something is wrong. And for me, it was in the wake of 9/11 that I became very, very serious in my mind about trying to figure out, well, what is the true story if it can be proven that the official narrative is bunk, then what is true? And so I put myself on that course of action that I took very seriously. And I became involved with a political organization for about a decade, from 2006 to 16, called the LaRouche Organization. It's a small organization that had a little branch in Canada with some big ideas. I'm no longer with them, but it was a big part of sort of changing my attitude from being sort of a voyeur to being somebody who was putting myself into the process I was trying to piece together. And so I guess my research has flowed from my own desire to try to make sense of things, but then a sense of wanting to play some role in helping others to both understand causation, but then with the idea and the faith that with knowledge comes a power to act upon that process that's bringing us towards a tragedy. So I do have a sense that if people are able to get a proper grasp of what has brought us historically to this moment of crisis, that we would be able to have more access of our creative powers and could think through solutions more readily than we could if we were ignorant. So that's sort of what I'm acting on in my book series, my videos that I've done, the websites that I've created and what have you, kind of stems from that source. I don't know if that helps to answer that question.
It certainly does, Matt. And David, what about you? If you could just introduce yourself as well.
Sure. So my name is David Livingston. I'm an independent researcher. I've been at it for a few years. I've written seven books now. The last three would be the 3 books ago was Ordo Ab Cal, which is a 6-volume work. Then I did another one on Zionism, and most recently one, a return to the subject of Islam. Basically, I think, I've often been concerned with issues of justice. I guess a lot like Matt, just to recognize a lot of inconsistencies in the world we're living in and try to make sense of it. I spent some time at, Matt, I'm also based in Montreal. I went to the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University. And that was particularly interesting because that's where in fact, my subject of study was Western civilization. And we've gone into this before, Tony, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but basically it was the full brunt of the version of propaganda that's being taught, particularly in the West and in North America. I've studied the background of it to understand where exactly that came from. So I recognize now to what extent it was a version of propaganda. And there were just certain anomalies that I noticed as I was studying it. And after I left, I started to follow some of the threads that seemed really curious to me. And that's when it led me to see that a number of certain topics, some pretty important ones, and this is interesting because probably the most important one, the one that actually started off my research, was the subject of the Aryan race. In my textbooks, they weren't re referred to as Aryans. They were referred to as Caucasians or Indo-Europeans. And I eventually learned that the origin of the legend was shaped by Masonic legends, particularly the legend of Atlantis and the sons of God, or quote-unquote Nephilim, and of Genesis. So, of course, that struck me as pretty darn strange, and I wanted to know how this could be. So, how could these modern secret societies exercise such an influence, and then where do they come from? The accounts of their own origins are mostly legendary, and so I was curious to find out what were the real origins? And that's when I traced it all back to the 6th century BC, and the origins of the Kabbalah amongst the Babylonian Magi, and how that evolved into Greek philosophy, Hermeticism, the mystery cults of the Hellenistic times, and how that basically created the foundation for what they call now the Western esoteric tradition. And what's important is that, why it's important, bring back what you how you want to bring this around, Tony, is that there are various agendas in place. There are people who are pursuing agendas, and the only way to understand the agendas don't have the goals that are normally publicized. They have alternative reasons for pursuing these goals, and the only way to understand them is to understand how they have derived these ideas from an occult tradition. And the only way to understand that is to trace it, and it requires quite a bit of detail of exploring 3,000 years of how this thing has developed, so you can see how it has been preserved over the times, who has been participating in its preservation, to understand how it has evolved to the point that it is today, and how it is fundamentally shaping the world we're living in, primarily through things like Zionism, concepts like the New World Order, transhumanism, artificial intelligence, and basically most of the key driving agendas that we're experiencing today.
Well, I suppose it could sort of sum this up by seeing it as a kind of weight that the ancestors have left, that we are it's now a burden on us, and we have to try and disentangle it, looking back through history to find what it is that's really been going on over the years. And you can see kind of piles of different generations piling on more and more of these kind of myths about what's been happening and what's in the past, you know, how we got where we are. I think Orwell sums that up beautifully. I know it's a well-known quote in 1984. He who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. So I'll ask you both, maybe you first, Matt, what you think are some of the really important events in history that maybe aren't given anywhere near as much attention as they should be, that brought us where we are.
That's a great big question, and it's difficult to even decide where to begin. I suppose from my standpoint, one of the most underrated periods, I suppose, in my research, and I brought this up in a couple of chapters in volume 4 of my Clash of the Two Americas book on the Anglo-Venetian roots of the deep state, where I did a little bit of work on this period of a Renaissance dynamic that had begun occurring in a big way in the middle to late 8th century. And you had this strange configuration of civilizational forces that had all experienced a Renaissance dynamic around the same period. And that includes, the Carolingian Renaissance that saw this like massive burst of beautiful architecture, new discoveries, internal improvements, sanitation. There was a literary movement as well that was quite big, training of orphans to read. And you had the Abbasid dynasty. So you had this Renaissance dynamic of the Abbasid period as well. Where you had the growth of these houses of wisdom and various Jewish and Christian and Muslim scholars that were meeting together to do translations of ancient works, astronomy, a variety of things that accompanied a revival of the Silk Road that the Tang Dynasty had brought back online after 400 years of disarray. There was like a something like 30 different dynastic sort of I guess you could say warlord emperors that came and went after the Han Dynasty collapsed, and the Silk Road that went on for about, I guess the 2nd century BC to the 2nd century AD. It completely fell apart during that time, and it began to be revived under the Tang Dynasty in around 684. And so it wasn't just trade and spices, but also cultural ideas that manifested in I think, a better understanding of each other's cultures. And with that understanding was a reduced capacity to have these divide to conquer wars between civilizations that the empire always kind of needs to just control the chaos on the chessboard. So you had this like this dynamic that's just so interesting, and I wrote quite a bit about that. That also brings in the high, Kingdom of Khazaria that everyone likes to have an opinion about, and I found that in my assessment based on the Muslim scholars that I was reading, it wasn't really this nefarious evil domain of Satanism that many amongst the conspiracy theory crowd today have been led to believe, but it seems like it was playing a more positive role in this dynamic of cooperation, which it took a while for the heirs of Harun al-Rashid and Charlemagne to become, basically puppets of the empire and undermine that dynamic of what I think is a healthy ecumenical cooperation in terms of creating a situation that led directly into the Crusades that was accompanied with the rise of these various esoteric Gnostic mystery cults that really directed that entire shit show, whether it was the Hashashins that I know David has written quite a bit about, or the Templar Order and its variety, its various Gnostic chivalric groupings that manifested in a number of ways to basically just get everybody to have a ritual mass murder campaign for centuries around this idea of the revival of Solomon's Temple. So I think that that period is something that a lot of people haven't looked that deeply about or haven't appreciated the importance of the that set, 7th to 9th century period. Yeah, there's a lot of things I could have said that would have been other periods that people don't pay attention to, but that's the one that my mind just went to when you asked the question.
Okay, right. And David, what about you? If you can maybe point to a couple of things in history that have been neglected, that have been important in getting us where we are.
Yes, I would, and it would overlap with some of the things Matt said. Can I ask Matt a question? Matt, are you saying that you see a role of Khazaria somehow in this Renaissance?
Yeah, it's looking. I've got a bunch of data sets that I've pulled together that indicate in my mind that there was an active positive role that Khazaria was playing on a diplomatic and military level. If you want me to say some words about that, I could, but I don't want to take away from your.
Yeah, Co, quickly, if you
Yeah,
can fill that one
please
in there,
do.
Matt, please.
Okay. I don't have the Muslim scholars the names. There's like five or six Muslim geographers and historians at the time of the 9th to 11th centuries who wrote about Khazaria. Like a lot's been completely flushed, so there's very little to work with. But we have these scholars who lived and saw and wrote about. And one of the things that they pointed out is that the Khazaria didn't actually have a standing army. They actually had a Muslim army of 5,000 soldiers that were provided by the Abbasids. And the program upon which this Muslim army, which lived in Khazaria, that I think I'm not going to say more about that because I think the people listening to this program are familiar with the geography of Khazaria and the time frame. But
Well,
they
yeah,
had a
the
program where.
Caspian Sea, a Khazaria is notorious for doing a mass conversion to Judaism.
Yeah, under King
Reportedly.
Bulan around the seventh, yeah, mid 8th century, and so this Muslim army had a program where they would fight to defend Khazaria under any circumstance where unless this Jewish kingdom found itself at war with the Muslim kingdom, at which point they would turn on the Jewish kingdom, which was a very interesting agreement and a big act of faith. And also the Supreme Court, so it was run by a court of judges that was very well represented. So the masses who lived in Khazaria were not Jewish, the people. It was like the governing class, but the governing class had this judiciary that had equal representation, like two Muslim, two Christian, two Jews on this court that determined the laws of the society that even the king was beholden to. And then there was this a lot of information pertaining to the provision of diplomatic envoys that would help broker peace arrangements between the Charlemagne and Harun al-Rashid when there were efforts by the Vatican, this like Gnostic network in the Vatican that were trying to get a crusade going back in the like 800 or so, even at the end of the 8th century, early 9th century, there were efforts to get the crusade going. And so there were these incredibly creative maneuvers help that were brokered by these Jewish envoys to avoid the war, which I write about in my book. So I think that they were positive overall. I don't think that they were as negative as people think.
Well, I love the way you've just brought in this whole concept of empire where the successful parts of empire always seem to be where there is some form of proper justice going on, and so there aren't these divide and rule wars, and that the trade can flow and the empire gets its way. But anyway, David, I hope that helps answer your question.
Yeah, it does. Thanks. Yeah, just to support your point, man, I think, there's often an error to try to see nations as being collectively conspiratorial, right? That's not really the way that's not the way they operate. And there's maybe conspirators within nations, but they're usually some kind of like a rogue group within a nation. But that's why there's often this mistake to try to pin too much on the Khazarians, but they're a very important subject because, of course, they emerged in the Don Valley Basin, which recurs many, many times. That's also the place of origin of the Scythians, and so it's all interconnected, overlapping with all kinds of legends, right? So particularly legends of Gog and Magog, the legends of the Lost Tribes. So this is how the because they've done genetic studies, and the topic of Khazaria has been highly exploited, as you know. They've done genetic studies, and European Jews are descended from basically the area of Palestine, but there have been some studies that have traced some genetic elements back to the possibly the Khazarians. And but even beyond that, the Khazarians themselves were traced back to, I think, the tribe of Simeon or tribe of Reuben or something like that, who came there sometime, after Babylonian exile. So they were also traced with the Edomites, which is why you find that there were descriptions of both the Scythians and the Khazars as being often red-haired and blue-eyed or green-eyed. And that's a really, really recurring theme. And it's really important because this seems to be a theme that has been picked on by occult historians, of course, most popularized by people like Dan Brown, right, who fixates on Mary Magdalene's red hair as being somehow a trace of her ancestry back to Jesus. But there's also a good book by Paul McDowell called Red Jews and Antisemitism. So he basically shows how, the whole, all the legends around Khazaria and all that were so much interconnected with, again, Gog and Magog, the Lost Tribes, and this whole legend of the Red Jews, because part of the anticipations for the end times is that the Red Jews, who are equated with the Lost Tribes, are supposed to come forth to assist the Messiah in his conquests of the world. And so even through the Middle Ages, red hair typically was associated with Jews. So, of course, as is well known, the highest concentration of Jews is in Scotland, and then outside of Scotland would be amongst Jews, and then amongst certain peoples, there's like places of Pakistan and stuff like that. But so it's curious then, when you think that there's, this apparent purportedly the name of Scotland derives from Scythia, and there's even, you probably heard about the Declaration of Aberath, am I pronouncing that correctly? That traces the descent of the Scots back to Scythia, which could possibly connect it to the Khazars. So to get to your point, to your question, Tony, why this is interesting, because I've been trying to make sense of what is the significance of the Khazarian history? Because there's two people at least who played a foundational role in what would basically become the families behind the Crusades. So one of them is Agatha Bulgaria. So there's a famous case, and I can't remember the detail and who it was now. Like, these are all details I used to have memorized, but now I got too many to remember. But it's Agatha Bulgaria, who was brought from out of Bulgaria and brought, and she, I guess, wedded would have been Malcolm III, who was the father of David I, the King of Scotland, who was a patron of the Templars. And it's interesting here, of course, that Malcolm, of course, was a Scottish name, and David would have been a biblical name, which seems to have initiated a transition of the Scottish aristocracy to a sort of more a biblical. An identification with the biblical heritage, and they become crucial in the history of the Templars. And then there's another lady who's particularly important is Elizabeth of Hungary, because there's a whole legend inside of the Zvezda Hung. It's a Hungarian legends of the Hungarian ancestry, and Hungary was founded by the Magyars, and the Magyars basically came out of the area of Khazaria after that kingdom was destroyed. So there seems to have been a dispersion of Khazarians after the end of their empire, I guess in the 9th century, if you mind me the details of that, I'm not sure. And they seem to have spread in different parts, and Hungary seems to have been one of their main points, because then this Hungarian aristocracy becomes really crucial. So Elizabeth of Hungary, she becomes famous as for performing what's called the Miracle of the Roses. So she apparently, I can't remember what the circumstances, but she lifts her skirt because her husband catches her feeding the poor or something like that. So she lifts her skirt and all these roses fall out from under her skirt, which is a connection of the Ionic symbolism of the rose, because this, of course, is crucial to the Kabbalah, where the rose is the symbol of, according to the Zohar, the Jewish congregation. And so this is from this point on that you get the symbolism of the rose disseminating itself across Europe. Her father-in-law was Hermann the first of Lutheringia, who had sponsored the what's called the Singerkrieg, which is a song contest, which where Wolfram von Eschenbach produced the Tale of the Night Swan. And the Tale of the Night Swan was basically a, you know, a demonic slash spirit who appears on the shore drawn by swans. He becomes the father of Godefroy of Bouillon, the leader of the First Crusade. So all these families are all connected. They all basically tie themselves back to the legend of the Night Swan. And they go back to Guillaume of Cologne that I've traced before. And so the family of Agatha of Bulgaria also marries into this entire network. And this produces the aristocratic families, particularly of Anjou in France, the Plantagenets in England, the what are the other regions? Most of the basically the leading families who precipitated what's called the First Crusade, or also known as the Prince's Crusade. And the Prince's Crusade basically, so what's interesting now is that, you know, all these themes were originally basically can be traced back to the Kabbalah. So even Wolfram von Eschenbach claims that he got his story from a I think I guess it was like a Jewish convert to Islam from Spain or something like that, and that Flegetanus, I think, is what his name was, effectively implying that it's a Kabbalistic legend, because really all these families, particularly in southern France, are very closely connected to the Cathar movement. And the Cathar movement basically was a Christian manifestation of the Kabbalistic influence. A very important person was Rashi of Troy. Rashi is an acronym, but he's one of the probably the most famous and respected Jewish scholar of the Middle Ages. He's also considered one of the first original founders of the Zionist movement, because he articulated that the Jewish people were entitled to repossess the land of Israel. We'll go on another topic. This is novel because it goes against the three oaths, but that's another topic. But Rashi of Troy was working with Hugh of Champagne, Hugh and he was also part of a school that was teaching Stephen Harding, who was a friend with Bernard of Clairvaux. So it seems evident to me that there was a plan afoot to try to mobilize a Christian army to conquer Palestine, which was an absurd object militarily. It was a complete absurd objective. But as you know, I can't go into the details, but I hypothesize that there's long been a tradition that there was treasures buried, a tradition held by certain ranks of Jewish philosophers, scholars, that there was a treasure buried beneath the temple, and that's what they're out to get. And what they seem to have discovered is a book called the Sefer HaBahir. And I think that's probably the most crucial point, the turning point in history, because what happens is that, you know, as I mentioned, the cult movement begins in Babylon in the 6th century BC and then goes to Plato and Pythagoras and Hellenistic times and flourishes with like cults like Mithraism and the mysteries of Isis, Osiris, and all that stuff, Neoplatonism, Hermeticism. But what happens is that with the conquest of the Roman conquest of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Second Temple, you effectively get the mystical tradition in Judaism is effectively squashed. And this is exactly the topic that people like Gershom Scholem and Moshe Edel have tried to tackle. Another one is Nathaniel Deutsch, is the puzzle of how is it then that Gnostic ideas that had been marginalized for 1,000 years suddenly appear in the late 1100s. And so they appear in the form of the book called the Behir, which comes to them. They even have trouble putting it together because it comes in bits and pieces where there's parts missing and like certain senses are cut off. So they can't explain it. So my hypothesis is that it was discovered in excavations conducted by the Templars inside of the old Temple of Jerusalem. And that's basically the turning point of history, because that's effectively the time that the occult tradition manifests itself in the West. First, what they do, the Templars, of course, go and are introduced, inducted, initiated to this conspiracy by the Assassins, because that's where the occult has survived, has survived in the Middle East. And what's curious is that the next stage where the Templar legend and influence emerges is after the Renaissance. The Renaissance was sort of a percolation of these themes, but they sort of really manifested their political influence with the Rosicrucian movement, which was led and sponsored by the House of Hessen-Kessel, who traced their descent directly back to Elizabeth of Hungary. And then the rest is history. Then, of course, one of the most important members of Illuminati, a sponsor, one of the most important political conspirators of the late 1800s, he was a member of Illuminati, also Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren, which is a Sabbatian Frankist organization, was Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel, who traced his descent directly. He was a direct successor after how many generations from Maurice of Hessen-Kessel, the sponsor of the Rosicrucian movement, both of them tracing their descent back to Elizabeth of Hungary.
Okay, Matt, over to you. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean that. Yeah, that was pretty comprehensive. Quick question: where do the Normans play into this process? Like, what were the Normans, and how? Yeah, how did they play into the driving force, or at least not maybe one of the key
One of
players
these.
behind the Crusades and the
Yeah.
Templars?
So again, it's a nation, right? So I would shy away from making a nation culpable of anything in particular, but there was Normans who did play a role. So the founder of the Norman nation, of course, Normans means that they're Norsemen, right? Those are the Vikings who settled in northern France, and they later became as Normans. And they the it was founded by Rollo the Viking. And so, according to some genealogies, Rollo the Viking was married, I think, to a descendant of Guillaume of Gallone. So Guillaume of Gallone is important because apparently there's a lot of legend around this, so it's hard to know exactly, how true this is. But sometimes it's more important to know what people believe as opposed to what really happened, because this is the legend that has been was resurrected by the authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And then, which was basically plagiarized by Dan Brown. And that's the idea that Guillaume of Gallone was in reality Rabbi Makir, and that Rabbi Makir was a Jewish exilarch, because in Islamic Empire, the various religious communities were allowed to govern themselves and appoint a leader amongst themselves. So the Jewish community had appointed what they call an exilarch, and he claimed descent from David. So apparently, at some point, there was a dispute between two rival successors, and one of them basically fled in exile and came to southern France, and there he was recognized by the Jewish community of what's known as Septimania. This is all based by the on the research of a Jewish scholar called Arthur Zuckerman. I think it's called a Jewish Princedom in Septimania or something like that. And because he hypothesizes that when there's a reference in a book called the Sefer HaKabbalah by Abraham Daoud, if I remember correctly, Abraham David maybe, that It refers to a close relationship between Charlemagne and the Jews, and he surmises that that means some kind of interrelation, basically intermarriage. But it's fascinating because Guillaume de Gallon becomes a hero of various sort of early chansons de geste and things like that, and becomes very much a legendary figure. And what's interesting is that you can trace so much back to him. It's his son or grandson, William of Aquitaine, I think is what it was, who was the founder of the Abbey of Cluny. And the Abbey of Cluny is central to the entire Christian history of the early Middle Ages. They're pretty much the architects of the Crusades. Yeah, I think what was the Pope who announced the Crusade? He was a former, he belonged to the Abbey of Cluny, if I remember correctly.
That
And
was the Cistercian Abbey, right?
he, yeah,
So
I'm
is
not sure.
this William of Aquitaine, was this also the first troubadour, the grandfather of
No, it's a different
Alfred
one.
Aquitaine?
Yeah, so
It's
that
a
would have
different
been
guy?
his that would have been like his descendant, who
Okay,
then
so
was
this
the
guy is Kim's.
grandmother
Okay.
later, yes, who would then
Hey,
would have
look,
been the
Matt, I want
grandfather
to
of.
go to you actually and get your take on the Crusades, because if we're talking about this period, I mean, everybody with half a brain cell can surely see that we've seen a kind of revival of the Crusades with the First and the Second World War, with the British taking Palestine, the creation of the Israeli state in 1948, etc. And that's caused quite a lot of trouble over the last few decades. But what's your take on the, potential link between the original Crusades and this modern one? Oh, well, I see them as sort of, I mean, it's one thing. I don't see them as two different things per se, but I do think that that ignoring the role of these Gnostic societies, these initiatory mystery cults that masquerade as either Christian or Jewish or Muslim is a big mistake that a lot of people who try to talk about the Crusades, they make the same mistake, because it's these agencies that are colluding together. And which are initiating the thing which we can map out as being the sort of this forever war that, it did end up coming to an end after some centuries, but it was very, very eschatological. It was very much premised on a certain notion of restoring Solomon's temple. A lot of David made the point that the Templars were being influenced by the earlier what do they call the Hashashins, the Nizari Ismaili groups that were set up by this dude named Hassani Sabah, who was himself it seems a they're sort of like this Islamic Kabbalism, this version of Kabbalah within the Islamic world too, that's called the Batinia. So he was a Batinia missionary. And it's premised on this notion that you've got the Quran that's written that anybody can read, and then you have the secret Quran that's oral, that's transmitted by initiates onward and onward, which becomes a bit of a game of whatever, like whoever can just kind of make up the most persuasive story and construct an institution around it, kind of makes they kind of define what the truth of the secret Kabbalah is. So there are these groups that have pursued or pushed this notion that Muhammad had a secret teaching when he was up on, talking with the angels, that he only, that was not accessible to the uninitiated ear. And so the Batiniyats, one is called the Zahir and the other is the Batini. So the Batini means hidden. Zahir is for the profane. And so, he sets up this thing called the Hashashins, and they have this Alamut fortress, and this is about 1090, and a few years later the Hospitallers are set up to help oversee the first crusade. And then that's set up by this guy named Gerard de, oh it's a Benedictine grand strategist, Bernard de, not de Clairvaux, oh it'll come to me later. But anyway, it's a Benedictine grand strategist from Italy that sets up the Hospitallers. And then a few years later, you've got the Knights Templar, the Poor Knights of Solomon's Temple also set up. And it seems like they're interfacing together with the Hashashins, who are giving them a lot of the program for the initiatory rites. They're helping them redefine what they thought certain symbols are regarding the cross or other things. I don't know if it's true per se that the Sefer Bahir was truly discovered in Solomon's Temple. It might have been, and then was like translated and became sort of the backbone of the new Kabbalah system that generated the Zohar and stuff like that in the Middle Ages. Of course, a lot of the true believers want to pretend that this stuff is super ancient. I'm kind of on the fence. I think there's probably a little bit more probably made up by religious engineers at the time, I think, and then passed off as if it was this ancient thing. Could be wrong, but that's what I'm thinking at least. But all that to say, these groupings were happy to work together to kill each other's enemies. So, you know, anytime there was a Muslim leader that was in danger of creating a peace treaty with a crusader representative or somebody from the Christian world, they would get assassinated. And, you know, then, and they would often get assassinated by one of these Hashashins. And inversely, you know, Saladin, for example, had two assassination hits that he avoided by the assassins. And, you know, they were also hired by Richard of Lionheart at one point to kill one of Richard of Lionheart's so nominally Christian enemies, you know, that I forgot the name. I don't think it was Baldwin. But there was somebody whose position he wanted, and he basically got that person murdered by the Hashashins. And it was Saladin who tortured one of the captured assassins and forced them to admit that they'd been hired by Richard of Lionheart. So you can see, like, there's a lot of evidence, data points, that they're actually working behind the scenes together to keep the Forever Wars going as part of a ritual mass murder program.
Why this obsession with the Holy Land, with Jerusalem, Palestine? Why are they obsessed by that?
Well, I think that there's certain eschatological stories that date back to even before Christianity and Islam and even Judaism were brought online in the forms that they took, that deal with in my assessment, I think that they have a view of Solomon's Temple as being a very sacred space that was at the center of, and I'm not saying that this is true, I'm just saying that, like David is saying, it's sometimes useful to just read what these occultists say about what they think Solomon's Temple was, that they want to like revive to usher in a new age, because it's very millennialist. Like they operate on this like ritual of a 1,000-year cycle that requires these periods of purgative violence to punctuate the opening up of a new age. And it seems to me that the Crusades were supposed to be this ushering in of this new age, reviving the program of Julian the Apostate, who promised to rebuild Solomon's Temple for the third time. That didn't work out back in the 4th century, but they wanted to do that. And they have an idea that that's a mass human sacrifice zone. I know when I read the writings of Sir Charles Warren, who like set up the Quartier Coronati Lodge, which also Michael Benioff from the Holy Blood, Holy Grail author, he's also a member of the Quartier Coronati Lodge that excavated Solomon's Temple in the 1860s, 70s. Although they were officially set up in the 1880s, but anyway, they already existed before that as the Freemasonic Research Lodge. He was of the view that the zone under, for example, the Dome of the Rock, which is near Solomon's Temple, that was sort of where the Templars had their home base, was a mass human sacrifice zone. And they had these tunnels under these two, there's sort of two compartments under the so-called, you know, it's not really the rock, but it's supposed to be the rock where Abraham was told to kill his son and the angel stopped him. Under that rock, there's like a sub-compartment. And then under that, there's another compartment out of which there are these massive tunnels that distribute supposedly human refuse and blood into the soil of the adjacent region. And that was, in Charles Warren's thinking, who was a major occultist, the center of a global high priesthood in the ancient world that they want to revive as sort of the new organizing principle of their new age that they want to bring in. And I think that the Templars probably had something witchcrafty like that going on in their minds as well, that presumed that you had to sort of manifest a type of cataclysm, a purgative violence that involved interpreting the battles of, you know, the stories of Gog and Magog from the Bible in a certain way, and ushering in the Antichrist and all this other stuff. But they seem to kind of want to, it's the Pygmalion effect. You know, they kind of want to bring the new age, and they interpret it as meaning you got to kill off most people that live and then bring, and, you know, then they end up doing it. And then they, like George, you know, George Bush saying, well, see, it's, you know, we're at the battle of Gog and Magog because of us bombing the Middle East, and it's here, it's now. It's like, but you kind of made it happen. It's not really God's decision to do this at this point. That's kind of you doing it, right? It's sort of dishonest.
Well, look, cults, I think we have to go there and look at how these cults operate. I remember reading Elizabeth Murray and her book, The Witch Cult in Western Europe, and
Yeah, that's
also
it.
The God of the Witches, which, I mean, she was a particularly interesting character in that she started off as an Egyptologist and then she suddenly sort of swerved in the 19, around about 1920, I think, to look at the echoes of much of the sort of pharaoh worship style way of doing things, and saying, well, actually, this has been going on for thousands of years right across Europe underground. And so, as an anthropologist, she was looking at it very dispassionately, but fascinating to see the way that these cults operate. And you're right to talk about witchcraft in parallel with Freemasonry, because a lot of the rituals are very, very similar. It almost looks like,
Well,
this is the kind of.
the Templars, I think, really were the first case of like modern witches that were like it seems like they were carrying out hardcore witchcraft, and a lot of the chivalric orders actually have at their core, warlocks who are like, the cousin of James the First, of Scot or of England, who is a I think Mer and Margaret Anne Murray also points out that he was also a very high level witch. That was trying to kill and make himself the king of Scotland and then the king of England, as a Stuart. But yeah, they're everywhere, these things. These witches are, I think they're very tied to the Templars, though.
Yeah, and the idea is that it's secret knowledge, it's hidden knowledge. The idea is that they're working in concert. So, for example, with the head of one coven is also part of the 13 in a higher coven. It's very hierarchical like that, and that's also, of course, been mixed up with many of the individuals. Very difficult to know who exactly, but Margaret Murray certainly had a go within the European aristocracy. But anyway, David, what do you make of this? We're looking specifically at the parallels between what we're seeing now and the medieval crusades.
I'd like to come back to the point that you raised, Matt, about Charles Warren. That's particularly fascinating. I didn't realize that that's what he believed, because he's been essential for my thesis, because he was also part of a team that conducted, that discovered that the Templars had conducted excavations. And that's what I use to substantiate my claim that the Templars could have discovered the Bahir. And so there's two things that make Charles Warren interesting. Is one is that, like you said, he's linked to Qatar Coronati, but he's also linked to the he was linked to the Palestine Exploration Fund. So that's really kind of like the beginnings of the British Zionist movement. They were going out to ostensibly, carry out these surveys of the Holy Land, but of course it was to prepare their reconnaissance for an eventual conquest. They were also this is also the same group that set up the first Masonic Hall in what they called Solomon's Quarries. And what's interesting is that after he conducts his mission to the I guess it was for the PEF, for the Palestine Exploration Fund, then he comes back to London and he heads the investigation of the Jack the Ripper murders. And this is why he's central in my chapter on the Jack the Ripper murders and my study of the burgeoning Zionist movement. There's so many curious overlapping relationships. Quattro Coronati is very closely linked with the Golden Dawn, and of course the Golden Dawn is a neo-Frankist organization, right? It's founded as a revival of the Asiatic Brethren. It's also founded as in reference to the Frankfurt Juden Lodge, which was also called sort of like a nascent dawn in German. And so yeah, so the Frankfurt Juden Lodge is where Edward Berlin was initiated. That's really how you get the birth of the occult revival.
It's the
And
Frankfurt Frankfurt Juden Lodge.
yeah.
Okay, young like Young Germany Lodge.
No, Juden, like Jewish lodge.
Oh, Jewish. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Because basically, of course, for that time, Jews were, officially forbidden from joining the lodges. So it was the first Jewish lodge that mostly only admitted Jews, and it basically mostly accepted members from the Asiatic Brethren, which were founded by Jacob Frank's nephew. The one of, I guess, I think the grand, well, who became the Grand Master or like the sponsor of the Frankfurt of the Juden Lodge was again Charles of Hessen-Kassel. Who was a grand, who was again a descendant of Elizabeth of Hungary, the Rosicrucian movement. It was Charles's brother, William Landgrave of Hesse and Kassel, who hired Meyer Amschel Bauer, who later changed his name to Meyer Rothschild, who founded the Rothschild dynasty. So all interconnected. And, right. So he, yeah. So Warren then heads the investigation into Jack the Ripper murders, which of course was a, some kind of strange Masonic ritual. The murders took place in houses, in buildings that were owned by the Rothschild because it took place in a Jewish district. There's all kinds of connections now back to people like, Randolph Churchill, the father of Winston, entire network. I was going to say, there's so many overlapping issues here. So basically, the like even somebody like Golden Dawn member, what's his name? The author of Dracula,
Bram Stoker.
Bram Stoker, right? His he basically his source for vampire culture was Armin van Buuren. In my I didn't realize how important Armin van Buuren was until I wrote my latest book on the history of Islam. He was a major conspirator in the last, in sort of for about a period of 50 years, leading up from the mid-1500s all the way to the founding of the Young Turks movement. He sort of had basically feigned a conversion to Islam for a while. He was friends with Ottoman royalty and leadership. He was basically, at the pinnacle of influences all over in British society. He worked closely with Lord Palmerston. And he was also a friend of Theodor Herzl. And so, of course, within the Golden Dawn now was overlapping very closely with the Zionist movement. A very important member was, sorry?
No, you finish your thought and then I have a question. Sorry.
Yeah, and Samuel Untermeyer, who is one of the sort of founding leaders of the Zionist movement. So to answer your point, Tony, what I see it is that, to back up what Matt is saying, this is an attempt to fulfill Bible prophecy by Gnostics, right? So we've talked about this before. These are people who believe in the prophecies, the Bible prophecies about the return of a Messiah, of the return of the Jews to Palestine, of the conquest of the world, of establishment of a global empire, and but they have a Gnostic interpretation of it, so they believe that this is a competition they have with the Creator. So they're working to bring about the same results, but from the other camp, and so this is why it seems to me that it begins with Rashi, because what's really important is that after the conquest of Jerusalem, they established the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And so all the descendants of these families continued to hold that title even after Jerusalem and the entire Crusader states were lost back to the Muslims. You have all these families who continue to retain the title of the title of King of Jerusalem. And I have an entire chapter on the kings of Jerusalem, particularly for the period during the Renaissance, because it's all of these families that were tended to be the sponsors of the occult tradition, particularly during the Renaissance and then beyond that. And this is sort of the symbiotic relationship that you see over the centuries, where you have aristocrats, because I believe that they recognize themselves as being descendants of the son of David, so that potentially carrying the seed of the Messiah or the Antichrist. And so they work closely with exponents or practitioners, leading practitioners of the occult, and they seem to collaborate. And this is how they sort of manifest this tradition over the centuries. A very important one, most recently, would have been Otto von Habsburg, who was Grand Master of the Order of the Golden Fleece. And so this is, really where this is what I studied well and show the overlap between, because he comes from the house of Habsburg-Lorraine, which dates back all the way to Maria Theresa, who was a sponsor of Jacob Frank. And if you come back to now Dan Brown, what you see is what the whole mythology that Dan Brown has produced, particularly around the list of the leaders, supposed Grand Masters of the Priory of Zion, the answer lies in looking at the history of the Golden Fleece and another order called Order of the Fleur-de-Lis, which is what the House of Habsburg-Lorraine was closely associated with, which is why the Priory of Zion envisioned having Otto von Habsburg serve as the sort of grand monarch, Nostradamus's grand monarch.
So if
So
they
again,
want to stage manage the end of the world, quite clearly they do want to control the Holy Land. It's almost like their center stage for their production, you know, that, but also that the Antichrist will be their Messiah.
Yes.
Anyway, Matt, you had a question.
I have a lot of questions, obviously, when you listen to David speak. Hard to even decide. I guess the originally when I asked the question, was just on the question. It's a trivial one, I guess, but just you brought up Armin von Barry, as being the inspiration for Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Okay, so
So
this is
he, the
okay.
character of the doctor, what a doctor's name in the story was apparently modeled on him, but he also basically consulted, sorry, Bram Stoker consulted him on vampire culture, on
Okay.
Transylvanian vampire culture.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Because he was
Prior to
also linked to the Pan-Turkish movement. So he was a major figure in the Pan-Turkish movement. So he was one of the theorizers of, you know, the legend of the It this all comes back, right? The whole Pan-Turkish movement is based on the Bektashi legends, right? And the Bektashi was a Frankist Sabbatian movement, was sorry, was very closely related with the Sabbatian Frankists of Turkey known as Donme. And so this is the whole idea about how the Turks originated in the Turks call it Ergenekon, but Ergenekon is the equivalent of Agartha.
Oh, I see. Oh, it's got a bit of a theosophical spin for the Turks, eh?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's
Oh,
the way
that's so
Van Berry
interesting.
decided, right? So this is where they came up with this whole idea of the Pan Turks, which I think you could probably, you know, safely trace back to this whole legend of the lost tribes and all that. And this is why it goes back to this whole idea of Hungary again and the legends of Hungary, which, you know, because it's the legends of it's the legend of the gray wolves, right? About how this is the origin of the Turkic people. And so that's why the Pan-Turkic movement was basically a Donme or Sabbatian movement. And this is why Rudolf von Sabbettendorf, before he founded the Thule Society, spent I don't know how many years in Turkey learning Kabbalah and mysticism and Freemasonry from the Young Turks and Domine of Turkey.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess another question I got here is you brought in Sabettendorf, so you know you're looking at like the Lanz von Liebenfels operation, the New Templar Order that seems to be a bit of a derivative from the German earlier New Templars that seem to have been founded in 1861, like around the exact same time as the Palestinian Exploration Fund is being created. You got this other thing, which also has its own eschatological sort of commitment to usher in the new age by colonizing Palestine and interfacing. Did you look into any overlapping cooperation between this German New Templar Gnostic order that later on it seems Sabettendorf is also part of, or at least amplifying, and the Charles Warren Freemasonic operation that are both in Palestine at the same time?
Well, there is one very important clue, and that's Lord Kitchener.
Right.
So Lord Kitchener, according to Lanz von Liebenfels, was a member of his New Templar order.
Oh,
And
is
Lord
it? I didn't know that.
yeah, so
Oh,
but
that's
Lord
very interesting.
Kitchener, right, and Lord Kitchener was a member of the PEF, the Palestine Exploration Fund.
That's good. That's
Yeah.
very useful.
And of course,
Okay,
there's
now
a
I'm taking.
paper noble. Go ahead.
No, go for that thought.
Yeah, so I think the main point of overlap is the Vienna Theosophical Society, right? Because then you get somebody, I think, what's his name? Is it Franz Hartmann, who becomes maybe the Grand Master? It was founded by a guy named Friedrich Eckstein, who was Jewish, a Jewish occultist, who was also friends with Freud. And so Hartmann is a key sort of node because he was a member of all the combined movements. So he was a member of the Theosophical Society, but he was also a member of the OTO. And so,
Right.
this, so that's the grouping. And then he was, I can't remember what his link was to Guido von Liszt, but it's largely members of Hartmann's society that joined Guido von Liszt society, I think. These are all the details that are covered in Nicholas Goodrich Clark's Area Sophie, if anybody wants the correct details. I'm not regurgitating them very accurately, but that's basically the confluence right there. So it's basically a combination. The Area Sophie is an emergence out of Theosophy and the OTO, and yeah. So, and the thing is that the occult revival itself, right? So, like the Theosophical Society, can all be traced back to Edward Bulwer-Lytton, who was initiate of the Frankfurt Judenlodge. But Edward Bulwer-Lytton, this is also detailed in another book by Jocelyn Godwin, who's an excellent occult researcher, in a book called The Theosophical Enlightenment. And he shows that the Edward Bulwer-Lytton was also a member of an order which called itself the Order of the Swastika, which would have been, flourishing in the mid-1800s. So most societies come from. And so what's interesting is that the swastika, the first use of the swastika was adopted again by Charles of Hessen-Kassel. This was a research done by a Dutch researcher. He looked at the archives. I guess it would have been the Asiatic Brethren. So the Asiatic Brethren adopted two symbols. So again, this was a Frankish secret society founded by Jacob Frank's cousin, Moses Dobruska. And so the purpose of it was because the dual symbol, so you had the seal, the six-pointed star, right? Also known as the seal of, the Star of David, but it was interchangeable with the seal of Solomon, because this is the idea that this was the seal that Solomon used to control the demons to construct his temple. And that effectively is the core of the legend of Freemasonry. And the reason why Charles of Hessen-Kassel adopted, so again, Charles of Hessen-Kassel, I hope you know, listening remembers the significance of this guy, because he traces all the way back to the Rosicrucian movement and Elizabeth of Hungary. But he chose the swastika as a symbol, as a dual symbol for the order, because it was an Indian symbol associated with reincarnation, which he identified with the Gilgul, which is the Kabbalistic version of reincarnation. So this is why basically you have like this emergence of, everybody adopted this. All these occult movements that could trace back themselves effectively to the Frankist movement use the swastika as their symbol, as did Elena Blavatsky. And then the same symbol then, of course, was adopted by groups like, people like Liebenfels and Guido von Liszt, and that's how effectively became a symbol of the Nazis, which as well is a millenarian organization which envisaged the rise of a Third Reich, and saw, of course, the need for human sacrifice on a large scale to accelerate the coming of the end times and the establishment of the thousand-year Reich.
Oh, this is accelerationism we're getting into now. But
Correct.
look, I've got to pull you up on something, David, because this whole thing of the Star of David or the Seal of Solomon, which I think is like an eight or nine pointed star, supposedly. I mean, Solomon didn't
It's
need
speculative.
demons to create his temple, did he? Because as I understand it was built by Hiram and the Phoenicians.
Well, we're talking about Masonic legends, not history.
Exactly, yeah, sure.
Right? So
Anyway,
we need to
Matt, do you want
distinguish.
to chip in here?
No, I would just maybe toss in a little bit pertaining to the ritual murders of Whitechapel quickly, and Solomon's Temple, because that's a point that's fascinated me for a while. And I forget that I'm not remembering the name of this author, but there's this Jack the Ripper scholar who brought to my attention the positioning of the bodies and where they were located within this district, the Jewish district, that over the course, it was maybe like a 6 month operation, and I was struck by the geometrical configuration, which was incredible. But it basically it the, these five canon like so there's five there were other murders that happened, but there's like five with what they call canon murders, which is like recognized as part of the same hand, like the same operation. And their bodies form the core of the Vesca Pisces, where you basically it's a symbol that has a lot of occult meaning. It's very important for occultists. that basically is generated when you have two circles overlapping that share a common radius. And you know, there's, it could look like a fish, it could look like a vagina, whatever. And so there's a lot of emphasis on the symbolic power of that. There's a lot of Masonic scholars that are very persuaded that Solomon's temple is built around the proportions of the Vesca Pisces, on a number of levels. And again, that's where the bodies are actually located. I go through that in my book on Edgar Allan Poe's Final Mystery and my Revenge of the Mystery Cult series. And when you look at some of the players within the Golden Dawn and the Isis Urania temple that was set up like right before, months before the Jack the Ripper murders began, there's a lot of people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who even like positions in his fictional stories the office, the home office of his character Sherlock Holmes, a year before the Jack the Ripper murders begin. But he situates the office in a building that actually becomes the headquarters of a cosmetics company in 1891 after the murders happen, of a trio. It seems like two parts of a witch coven, where you have this guy Roslyn Donston Stevenson, who seems to be one of the key. He's a disciple of Bulwer Lytton, a close friend of Charles Warren. He was a journalist for the Pall Mall Gazette in Jerusalem for many years during the excavations. And this guy is like, I don't think there was one Jack the Ripper. It seems like there was a multitude of operators who played this role together. It definitely needed Charles Warren to provide cover and this other Plymouth Brethren freak, Sir Robert Anderson, who also he ran Scotland Yard, but they were like running cover for this ritual murder. And this office, the address of this office is where this guy Robert, he actually called himself Roslyn Donston Stevenson. That was the name he wrote under. He sets up this cosmetics company with two theosophists, Mabel Collins and Victoria Kremers, who both of them end up working very closely with Aleister Crowley. One of them sets up is the treasurer of the Crowley Argentum Astrum Lodge that's set up in 1907. Mabel Collins is like was higher up in the echelons of the hierarchy of the theosophists and was part of the esoteric section under Blavatsky, even higher than Annie Besant. And there was some weird scandal created around some black magic she was doing with a few other theosophists, and she kind of gets kicked out, but I don't think she really does. She goes on to continue to work as, it seems, a witch under the warlock with Victoria Kremers. And so that, my point is that the interesting thing here is that building that they are working out of, creating these very strange cosmetic products, which is a strange thing for occultists to do. That's the same building one house down from Sherlock Holmes's fictional office on Baker Street, which is just wickedly weird. But a lot of these characters, they end up playing a direct role with Aleister Crowley, who has an inroad from a very early stage to these German occultists. And that also involves some Russian angles too. But his like second in command at the Argentum Astrum Lodge is this JCR Fuller, who's one of the he's a top military general in the British Army, ends up becoming one of the world top authorities on tank warfare. And his books and strategies are still taught today in West Point and military colleges, even now. But he's openly a Thelemite, and he becomes the back channel that Crowley uses for Hitler and especially Himmler, and the Nazi SS high command to bring in a Thelemic sort of method into the Nazi governing system. And there's a number of points. He's also very close to Oswald Mosley, who's also like working with the Theosophists. He's also very close to the Fabians, even though he's running the right wing hard Nazis, you know, British Union of Fascists operation in England. He's still tied to these seemingly left organizations. So it's the whole left right thing is a fraud. But you've got a number of inroads between Crowley, the Jack the Ripper thing, and this restoration of Solomon's Temple that they believe somehow operates on Vesca Pisces principles, geometrically speaking, and that even you know, Hitler played a big role in approving the or accelerating this this creation of the state of Israel, right? Like the Havara Agreement. People forget that that was a British-German agreement in 1933 that accelerated something like 60,000 to 80,000 Jews from Germany to be sent down into the desert to start creating the backbone of what would become this new artificial country that would be used in what I think is probably a mass sacrifice. And I don't know, like I was thinking about this too. I noticed the legend of the red Jews. I was thinking about maybe the red heifer too, is the heifer being a sacrifice. And, you know, whether it's Mithra, there's so many different sects that all treat the heifer as something as an important spiritual sacrifice, or a version of it could be the lamb, but the heifer is a big one. And that maybe part of that the legend of the red Jews might also involve the legend of the mass sacrifice that they want to bring about, is a hypothesis I'm chewing on right now. Because
Yeah,
I'm
well,
starting
I
to see
mean, it's a kind of a new age. It seems like the idea is to bring this new age out of the end of the world. You know, so this is the end of the old world and their age. But a part of all of this, I mean, you've been talking about the pharmaceutical industry there, and also bringing us a bit more up to date. I think it'd be really good to get both of your take on this whole concept of technocracy, especially since it has this little link to Canada. Maybe you first, David, with your particularly your book on Human 2.0, as they like to call it. What do you make of the, you know, what's the role of this, and does it connect up? I imagine it does with all these people, because it seems to me that there is this definite attempt here to bring in remote control decision making through AI, etc., and to bring a kind of almost like a kind of remote control decision-making system for the planet. But that hasn't just happened overnight.
If I could just add something to, because I'm really happy to hear you
Sure,
talk
yeah.
about Stevenson, Robert Downey Stevenson, because he's a central character that I came up with as well. You reveal a lot of facts that I didn't realize connected to him. I do write up though about Mabel Collins and Victoria Kramers, because they are both, like you said, they are members of the Theosophical Society as well as collaborating or disciples of Crowley. So Stevenson now was also working with a guy named William T. Stead, who was a very famous journalist at the time. And so he used to run basically a sort of a paranormal spiritualist magazine called the Borderlands.
Borderlands.
Right. So he wrote so so Stevenson published an article under the pseudonym of Tau Tria Delta. And so Stead claimed that claimed Stead believed that Stevenson was Jack the Ripper, as did Crowley. But what's interesting is that W.T. Stead, so not only was W.T. Stead a close friend and collaborator of both Blavatsky and Annie Besant, he was one of the four founding members of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable. So when we look at, when we look at the Balfour Declaration, it was a product of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable. When Herzl wanted to arrange a meeting with the Sultan, it was the first thing he did, wanted to meet arrange a meeting with the Sultan of Turkey. He used his friend Armin van Buuren as a conduit, right? And I can what's the other connection? So also I so when Cecil when Herzl wanted to basically Herzl reached out to Cecil Rhodes to sort of basically bankroll what the plot that they had in mind was that they wanted Cecil Rhodes to pay off this debt, the Sultan's debt, in return for being gifted the land of Palestine. So, so there you have it, Tony. I mean, that's the whole confluence of the, Edward Wilderton's disciple, the Golden Dawn, the PEF, Quattro Coordinati, the Jack the Ripper murders, Armin van Buuren, Theodor Herzl, and the Round Table, who really sort of, just at the time when the Zionist movement was really taking hold.
Just quickly before, and I know Tony, your question still stands, man, but just quickly to add to that, that plays into the Protocols of Zion that I know you've also written
Correct.
about, David. And in the Jack the Ripper murders, Sir Robert Anderson, who's like, a Derbyite from the Plymouth Brethren that also Aleister Crowley comes out of too, right?
Yep.
He's also working to promote this idea of a Jewish conspiracy to kill these women in the Whitechapel murders. So he's really pushing that idea, which they're reviving now, actually, is his very thesis that he was promoting. And Herzl is saying how useful this growing anti-Semitism is in Europe, because it's helping advance the cause of creating a Zionist state. So it all plays together, right? The protocols, the Jack the Ripper murders, all these laws that are tied to the Theosophists and the Marxists and shit.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's an excellent article. Unfortunately, it's in German. It's by isn't another one of the top occult researchers today. His name is Marcus Osterreiter. And he's the one who pointed out this connection, that he proposes that the protocols were sort of like a leak of the documents of the round table. And because it's an entire circle. So Pappas is the one, you know, the Pappas Gerard Onkelos, right? He's the one who's based, it's his circle who has been accused of being the circle of forgers that produced the protocols. So he was also working closely with Juliet Adams, who was another close friend of Willem T. Stead. And so I think it was Osterreiter who pointed out this connection of Stead, Juliet Adams, and Pappas as somehow being, you know, how the agenda of the round table was, you know, transformed into the protocols of Zion. So it's impossible to know, in my opinion, you know, how true the protocols are, because they were introduced to Sergei Nihlis by Yuliana Glinka, who was another disciple of Blavatsky, and even then it was a forgery of a book written by Maurice Joly, but Maurice Joly was associated with Adolphe Premier, who was the Grand Master of Memphis Mizraim and the founder of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, which is basically, I think you could pretty much pinpoint as the birth of the modern Zionist movement. Where was I going?
Look, I don't know, it's going to answer my question about transhumanism and how that fits in, because you know, obviously, if you're trying to, it's like herding cats, defining the future through human beings, because they don't even always do what you tell them to do. Computers are a little bit more obedient and a little bit less moral. They don't really have a soul that might resurge. So maybe you could just say something about transhumanism and how that fits into this sort of ride we're on towards the end of the world.
Yeah, so I mean, all these points are essential, right? Because Zionism, the protocols of Zion, because that's basically what shaped the 20th century, right? The World War II, the advent of Zion, of Nazism, was a crucial stepping stone to carry us into the future that we're living now, right? It's those are all the circumstances that allowed the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, right? The Zionist movement was able to plead to the world to say, look at, you know, the persecution we've undergone. Please, please, you know, we deserve a land of our own so we can no longer suffer this kind of persecution again. You know, basically falsely assuming roles as leaders of the Jewish people. So, you know, this is funny because it comes back to the point I wanted to mention earlier when you first asked the question of what was the transformational period. And I think the transformational period was the Treaty of Westphalia, which was the conclusion of the 30 Years' War, because what you get then is the beginning of the the Concord of States or something like that. It's the kind of the idea that that the world can be divided into states that have sort of mutual agreements between each other to recognize each other's borders, because that's the beginning of the establishment of the birth of the New World Order. You know, people think of the goal is to create, because of course the goal is to fulfill Bible prophecy where the Messiah returns, collects the Jews in Israel, and then they rule the world. So the idea is that it's going to be a global state. It's going to be a global state, but it's going to be a federated state. And that's what the purpose of the, so that's why the Treaty of Westphalia sort of was the first to lay the groundwork. And then you have the, I guess, what was the Congress that was concluded after the Napoleon Congress of
Vienna? Vienna,
right? So that's, again, the next major step that sort of really concretized this whole idea. Because in the past, what you had is you had the world was divided empires, right? You get somebody becomes a charismatic leader, gathers his people, becomes enormously powerful and conquers various nations and absorbs them into one single empire. And that empire is usually guided by some kind of an ideology so that multiple nations could be members of it, right? So, like the Roman Empire was composed of all kinds of nationalities and religions, as was the Persian Empire, the Muslim Empire. What you have novel in the idea of nations is that nations now are based on the some kind of artificial fabricated identity, which is usually tied to something very superficial, like well, sometimes religion, but usually ethnic identity, a language, and things like that. And what's also very important is that the architects of this new nationalism were mostly German philosophers associated with the Illuminati, like Herder and Fichte, who were also disciples again of Moses Mendelssohn, who was purportedly a successor of Shabtai Zvi, founder of modern Judaism through the Haskalah, which out of which comes the Zionist movement. So it all comes back together. So it seems like this Shridas Westphalia laid the groundwork for this sort of emerging division of the world into this mosaic of patchwork of states. So that 1948, after so the first thing that happened is that the United Nations was created. And then it's United Nations, which was given the authority and power to sanction the creation of the State of Israel. And if you look at what Theodore of David Ben-Gurion himself stated, he admits that he envisions a world where you will have a sort of a United Nations being a sort of serving as a global empire seated in Jerusalem with its headquarters in fulfilling Bible prophecy. And those are his words. So if we look at where we're going, that's where we're going. This ultimately is the real goal that we're headed to. Transhumanism and all these sort of artificial intelligence are just part of the mechanisms and tools towards that end goal. It again, Tony, it all comes back to accelerationism. It's all about accelerating the coming of the end times, and that's why these things are all interconnected. So, to make a long story short, the whole idea of transhumanism is based, and this is not my hypothesis. This is an AI. This is Bostrom, Nick Bostrom, who's one of the founders of the transhumanist movement. He wrote a book called The History of Transhumanism, and he traces it back to the legend of the Golem. He traces also like the alchemy and these other things, and to the Frankenstein legend, because the Frankenstein legend itself is based on alchemy. But it's this sort of this idea that comes back to the creation of an artificial being through Kabbalistic magic. And the person to articulate this in modern times was Norbert Wiener, who was one of the founders of the cybernetics movement, which is a CIA-backed movement to produce the personal computer and the beginnings of artificial intelligence. And he explained that to create, if what makes God God is the ability to create life. So if humans are able to create intelligence, effectively creating life, that makes them God. And this is the mission that Norbert Wiener prescribed. And so this is effectively became the goal of a project, long-term project, largely backed by the CIA to ultimately create artificial intelligence. And we've seen how this has manifested. And recently, it's ultimately its goal. I can, I'm not going to provide all the evidence to support my claim, but these are not my words. Their goal is to create, as was made evident with the Total Information Awareness Program of DARPA, is to create the all-seeing eye. So artificial AI is a goal to create sort of a god, a digital god, who will be able to be omniscient and to and from what I'm gathering from things that people like Musk are saying to you, basically I guess if it overlaps with the whole idea of technocracy, this being, this artificial intelligence will actually be able to even by feeding off of the entire collective of data of not only all of humanity today, but the collective of the accumulated human knowledge, it will be able to govern humanity. And that, I think, basically is the goal. So you combine this of, New World Order headquartered in Jerusalem as fulfilled Bible prophecy and the coming of an Antichrist slash, supposed Messiah. Somehow the goal of artificial intelligence is one and the same because it seems that their goal is to create this, a Grandmaster AI as some kind of a to have it worshipped as a being, it basically similar to me of the idea of the beast in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, so Elon Musk's grandfather, Joshua Haldeman, he had this. It's good to be talking to Canadians about this because the Canadian technocracy movement was something in the 1930s and the 40s. So this was also considered to be a little bit too pro-Nazi because it had these eugenics aspects, and a lot of these people went down to South Africa. But anyway, be great to hear, Matt, from you what you make of all of this technology. I mean, when I was a child, there was a BBC series called The Changes, which was particularly gripping because it was all about it was a TV kids drama, which they would never allow today, I don't think, because it was a little bit too shocking, where you find that the whole population in here in England anyway turns against all technology, and they start going around smashing up everything, which is like an electric light bulb comes in, people go weird, and then they start to smash it up. A radio is thrown across the street, people are in the street smashing up cars, this sort of thing. And but anyway, there was obviously some sort of feeling at the time, creatively, that maybe technology was getting out of control. Now, well, listen, I mean, that was 1975, so we're talking about 50 years on. It's way out of control. Technology is now creating these artificial images of children, which the British government is grappling with. They're not sure what to do about. We've also got, of course, Palantir and their artificial wars, where their software is being used to target families, kids, etc., all automatically. And the army leader can just switch off the command structure and switch on the computers, who can then go and target and kill for themselves. So what do you make of this, the where we are at now with this and the actual objectives?
I guess I was just still chewing on David's contribution, most of which I agree with. A few items I would provide a different hypothesis, which I'll try to speak to, and I'll address your question at the same time. In regards to Palantir, well, one thing that flows off of what David was talking about with the Total Information Awareness program that John Poindexter, who was a high-level Straussian neocon that went to jail for his role in setting up a shadow parallel government during Iran-Contra. He went to jail working with Ollie North, but then he got promoted when the Wolfowitz network came back into play, and he was assigned to set up the Total Information Awareness. And as David pointed out, the Eye of Horus was the selected symbol used to sell this new thing to protect American citizens from scary. Dangers like terrorism and everything else, and also protect Americans from their own thoughts, frankly, because thoughts lead to action, and action leads to terrorism, right? So anyway, that didn't go over so well at the time in 2003, and it's interesting that the same CIA operation that Poindexter interfaced with, called the InQtel, was what provided in 2004, the year after, or just even months after Total Information Awareness is put down, Palantir is created, and it's InQtel, the CIA venture capital branch, that's funding Palantir to basically do all the same thing that Total Information Awareness was promising to do, except now under a new civilian cardboard cutout. And of course, Palantir itself is a reference to the Lord of the Rings, or the all-seeing eye, that if whoever holds and looks into the Palantir can see, is basically omniscient and can see everything. So I think part of this notion that is part of the big myth of global control is this idea of the panopticon, that we are the slaves will not want to rebel to the degree that they feel like the gods are watching their every move and watching their every thought. And so that creates a bit of that Orwellian stop think, right? Before you have the dangerous thought, you don't even have the thought, because you predictively kind of know. It's this predictive, protective stupidity thing, where you know that you're going to get zapped by the invisible electric offense if your mind goes to certain places that it's not supposed to go. So it's nice self-policing. It works quite well. And I think at the top, those cyberneticist high priests who are pushing this transhumanist program religiously kind of know it's a magic trick, but they know that what they want is the effect of people complying to the imagined threat of what will happen to you if you don't. On the issue of Yeah, Elon Musk's grandfather in Technocracy Inc. and his role in Canada pushing this new reset of humanity. Yeah, he's directly tied to some high level occultists, including A.R. Oraj, who heads up the New Age magazine, a high level theosophist who coined the term social credit, which, you know, Joshua Haldeman ends up running the social credit party after his work with Technocracy Inc. doesn't go anywhere because he gets arrested for being a fascist in World War II. So, you know, you've got these high level occultists. They're publishing Crowley's works in Oraj's New Age magazine. That's what Major C.H. Douglas, a British, again, military intelligence figure who's developing social credit. He's a student under Oraj. Oraj is also working with Gurdjieff, who's this occult espionage figure, who's also, you know, he's acting as his personal secretary. So you got that going on with Elon Musk's grandfather before he goes to South Africa. But the whole idea again is to create back then, a thousand year occult psych of a high priesthood of elites that would manage the levers of production, consumption, thought, which was what Technocracy Inc. was all about. You know, like if they were successful, the idea was to just get rid of the system of sovereign nation states, get rid of the elected class, get rid of, you know, conventional capitalism as outdated things, and to be replaced by a new system of highly vetted experts to control society from above, which plays directly into the, it's like a proto transhuman thing, you know, and I mean, pulling it back a little bit further, this is what I think when you look at a lot of the preponderance of these groups in Silicon Valley and California, probably has a lot to do with Madame Blavatsky's call or her prediction, so-called, that the new root race, the sixth root race, will emerge in the West Coast of the United States. And specifically, she points out California, and it will be the Teutonic breed, which is sort of in her strange configuration of evolution, the sort of most advanced of the Aryan subroot races that's going to seed the new sixth root race, which is basically just a spiritualized materialism at the end of the day. But that will, you know, and that's Teutonic. That's this whole falls right into the Guido von List, Armin and order of Liebenfels and company, that I think, you know, all presumed that this, I mean, they had a whole Aryan Teutonic mythos that they created. Most of it's made like make-believe. It's not even real. They just made it all up to convey the notion that this is the most spiritual of all types of humanity that are endowed by destiny to usher in this new age. So Peter Thiel coming out of South Africa, I don't think is a coincidence. A lot of the unreconstructed Nazis that continued their magic trick under NATO's protection, probably not a coincidence that they're all part of, you know, setting up and grooming Silicon Valley. The Valerian brothers that founded modern Silicon Valley grew out of the Cortona Lodge, Theosophical Lodge, which also set up most of Hollywood as we know it, which had a lot of Crowleyites in there from the get-go in before World War I even. So you got this like really nasty thing. It's kind of latched on like a parasite. The only thing I would differ on my analysis from David's, what David went through, would be I've got a much more positive view of the battle to create the sovereign nation state out of the Peace of Westphalia. And I also I've been reading a lot of Moses Mendelssohn's writings over the years. His New Jerusalem book, for example, I read that twice, and I've been looking into also Lessing, who he was close friends with, and Schiller. I've been reading a lot of their writings, and I got to say, overall, I don't agree with that analysis that Mendelssohn was playing a negative role. It seems like he's fighting against this occult faction within Judaism and the Zionist movement in all of his writings and in his work. So I'm getting the sense he's a positive guy and Westphalia is a positive thing. So on those two points, I would differ, but on everything else, I would agree.
Yeah. So just flesh out what you mean about the nation state, because surely this is at least a fairly, for us little minions here, you know, this is a good thing where you haven't got empires, you know, overrunning each other, that you've got a sort of a pact, really, agreed borders. At least that means that the ordinary people have got a bit of a better chance of surviving a few generations.
when I looked at the organization, like how Colbert and earlier Mazarin organized the Peace of Westphalia, like it wasn't an easy thing. It seemed like it took them years and years to try to get to some point of agreements around which this thing could be finally created sufficiently that the Protestant and the Catholic factions could agree to something that would end the Forever War, which itself is a Rosicrucian Jesuit operation. The Rosicrucians and Jesuits did the 30 Years' War from the get-go. And I don't think that they ever wanted it to necessarily end at any given time. It seemed like there was a big fight. But one of the key things that made it work was not that it was based on the like creating of new regional controls to respect each other's board, like boundary conditions. It wasn't really that. But in the first two articles of the Peace of Westphalia, the treaty, as far as its preamble, was this idea that the new type of these new nations, so-called, would be founded upon a principle of the benefit of the other, in that self-interest would be defined not from a Hobbesian zero-sum standpoint, which is where the empire always wants to keep us thinking about our self-identity in a zero-sum sort of mindset, but rather from the standpoint of the benefit of our neighbors and the forgiveness of all past transgressions, which is another very Christian principle that it's difficult to mandate positive principles, but when they come through in law, I kind of resonate with that. And also the third aspect was, I think, the Colbertist dirigist programs of internal developments, which there were, like, you can count them and measure the transformation of the treasuries from war making into, and speculation too, which was rampant, into massive internal improvements, like the Midzi Canal, the biggest infrastructure project in history that was overseen. It was begun by Mazarin, then continued by Colbert, with like thousands of roads and schools being built and sanitation projects. A lot of things that I don't think the oligarchy, I don't see any of the dominant players within the oligarchical dynamic helping that. I see, if anything, Colbert is like flushing the system of, like, the Duke of Guise and a lot of these high-level Martinist and Rosicrucian types. Well, this is pre-Martinist. This is still Rosicrucian types who are running the deep state of France, who are being taken down by his program. So, it just seems to me like a lot of, like, when I look at the Congress of Vienna and the spheres of influence that came out of the Napoleonic Wars, that was not a, I don't see that as a heredity, like a spiritually hereditary evolution of Westphalia. I see that as like an abrogation or destruction of the Westphalian principle, or the Israeli idea of what a nation state was. I don't see that as being caused by Westphalia, but rather a doppelganger, perverse sort of zombie of what the nation state is that would justify its own eradication. So that's why I see the Westphalia nation state thing as overall, in principle, a good thing, although it could be infiltrated and turned into a bad thing. But right. I take a more nuanced approach there.
So, David, do you want to answer that briefly before we get up to date and round off?
Yeah, well, I'd like to come back to the point that, you know, the main thesis of my book on Zionism is that Zionism and Nazism are twin children of the Sabbatian movement, and the embryo is Moses Mendelssohn. The only historian that I know of who's done a detailed sort of conspiratorial study of the Sabbatian movement is Rabbi Marvin Antelman. He wrote a two-part book called To Eliminate the Opiate. And he discovered in a library in New York, I think it's the Schiff Collection of some sort, a document that had been collected by Moses Mendelssohn's best friend, which was Friedrich Nicolai. Friedrich Nicolai was the chief publisher of the Illuminati movement. And that list, it was a list of ordinations. So basically a list of the purported successors of Shabbatai Zvi. And there were a number before Mendelssohn, but they listed Mendelssohn as the final case. So I know that Moses Mendelssohn appears to have been, you know, opposed to some of the mystical traditions of Judaism, but I believe that was some sort of dissimulation, because his influence is recognized in his followers, and that is of two branches. So that's within Judaism, not just the Haskalah, but most of his disciples became leading members of the Asiatic Brethren, which was a Frankist cult founded by the cousin of Jacob Frank, who then become leaders of the Frankfurt Union Lodge. And secondly, he was close to almost the entire circle of leaders of the of the Illuminati. So that's Herder, Schelling, Lessing. Fichte wasn't a proven member, but he was closely connected with the whole gang. He was even friends with Immanuel Kant. It goes on and on. Goethe, of course, was another leading member. And what's interesting is that what happens now is that it's so the branch that came through the Asiatic Brethren is the one that evolved into the Zionist movement. His friends in the Illuminati were the founders of what became German nationalism, and principally through Herder. His Moses Mendelssohn's daughter, Dorothea, married Friedrich Schlegel, who's one of the most famous German historians of the time. He historian scientist slash philosophers, and he is the one who coined the term Aryan. And you can tell in his writing that he dropped hints that effectively connected the Aryans to descendants of Cain and Atlantis. And that's actually the first clue that led me to trace the occult origins of the Aryan legend. And it's from there that you have this parallel development. So hey, Schlegel was linked to an entire network of Illuminists, also Martinists. I detail all that in my book. It's too many threads to follow. And basically, it's it was Herder who provided the justification, the idea of the veneration of language, and the language as being the language of the folk, as he referred to it, which he believed somehow carried the identity of a people or a folk. And so this is the idea that really fed the early birth of German nationalism, and then it was carried forth by people like Fichte. And then you have one of the most important exponents. So everything takes place really in Weimar and the University of Jena. So the Weimar, what they call Weimar classicism. So there's the theory of Weimar, and that is a movement sponsored by Karl August of Sachs Weimar Eisenach. And he was a family now who could trace descent all the way back to they claimed descent back to the Night Swan, which is why the swan was so important. This is an important symbol in their dynastic identity. Purport, according to Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was Wagner's son-in-law, Wagner was a little bit child of Carl August's niece, which is why Wagner picked on the legend of the Night Swan, which of course he reportedly could claim descent from, and that became one of the most important mythic symbols of his work. And you look at Wagner, he was basically part of an entire circle of people who were affiliated with the Frankfurt Judenlodge, particularly Giacomo Meyerbeer. His father was one of the founders of the. This is where you come back now to the Hamburg Temple. And Hamburg Temple is basically the origin of where Reform Zionism gave its birth before evolving eventually into Zionism. So this whole Wagner network, Hamburg Temple, this is why Wagner eventually then becomes really the chief ideologue, inspired guru, basically, of the German nationalistic movement, which effectively was a Frankist movement. So out of the University of Jena, this is where you get the founding of the Burschenschaft. The Burschenschaft is basically the German university system, and it becomes the birthplace of the German nationalist movement. One of the founding figures is a guy named Father Jan. He was a member of a group called the Tugendbund, and the Tugendbund was named after an order of the same name founded by Moses Mendelssohn. And so again, this is how you get the birth of nationalism. So it's this entire network which basically feeds and produces German nationalism, which overlaps with various occult societies like Bull Relitin and the occult revival and the Guido von List and so on. Especially somebody like George von Schirnerer, who turns out to have been basically a Rothschild descendant as well, and most importantly. So George von Schirnerer becomes sort of like a leading, guiding figure, ideologue of this Burschenschaft movement, and that's where Theodor Herzl gets his start. He basically Theodor Herzl joins the Burschenschaft in Vienna, and becomes part of this Burschenschaft circle, and this is where he starts leaning toward German idealism as well as most of the Most of that movement, they belong to a group called the Pernistopher Circle, who were affiliated with this basically another key movement in German nationalism, and it was made up mostly of Jews, people like Mahler, Gustav Mahler, another member of the Theosophical Society, Freud. There's the Adler family, and of course, well, Herzl wasn't quite a member, but he was affiliated with that group. So, and what happens is there's a split from that point where the Frankist or the Jewish members sort of split off from the more overtly racist branch. But this is how basically how you get these twin branches. So one becomes more overtly anti-Semitic, and then you have the other group, which is a basically Frankist group. And this is how you get the branches sort of separate, one developing into Zionism and the one into Zionism. But you can see, sorry, Nazism, but you can, as we talked about earlier, there's constant overlap between the two groups. And that's what we're living. And that's why Elon Musk sported a Nazi salute at the inauguration.
Well, look, I'm going to have to drag you right up to today, folks. And I wonder if in, within about 5 or 10 minutes each, you could both give us your view on, this modern, the opening of 2026 is almost like a 12-gun salute, really, with the street fighting, rioting, applauded around the Western media over in Tehran and other cities in Iran, as well as the amazing kind of taking hostage of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela by Donald Trump, and the sort of general feeling that's coming out of Trump, which is in his little speeches where he says, actually, international law doesn't really matter anymore. Anyway, it's just whatever you think it might be and however I interpret it. And actually, I am only limited in US foreign policy now by my own morality, by my own mind. That's the only thing which is limiting it. And we've had headlines here. I was looking at one of the newspapers here today, saying British armed forces braced for an attack on Iran from the United States, with the British embassy being closed yesterday, and bringing all the forces back from certain places that they think might be the victims of retaliation by Iran if and when the United States strikes Iran. And then we hear this morning, oh no, it's okay, nothing's going to happen, it's all fine. So you've got all these headlines in front of you saying that there's going to be an attack because of a big uprising in Iran. So anyway, we're living in this very much a Orwellian world where no one's supposed to really know what's going on, and everything is very contradictory. So what do you first, Matt, what do you make of the opening of 26?
Well, unfortunately, it's going to be a very character building experience, and that's for sure. I do think that there is something to the interpretation of Blavat of sorry Alice Bailey's externalization of the hierarchy program. Whether she said 2025, that may be partially true, but I think that you are seeing in a certain sense the more subterranean elements that had created a nested series of wind up automatons, these sort of like nested games within games, ideological shells that kind of have their own flow to them once you wind them up and get them going. But they don't need that much input or direct intervention by the causal nexus of those high priests who put them into motion. Except now I think we're beginning to see a more active influence by that I guess, that Rosicrucian subterranean force. That very old evil is kind of coming to the surface in a more active way, which is where people's ability to discern reality from fantasy, from fiction, is becoming consciously undone. And it took a lot of decades of hypnotic induction and massaging of the zeitgeist through Hollywood and other forms of so-called entertainment and the drug culture, and our whole culture is pretty much weaponized, and it's been that way for before all three of us were born, right? Not to say it's all shit, but there's a lot of crap that's designed specifically to destroy our ability to use our sovereign reasoning faculties and to be more susceptible to becoming absorbed by the game that they've put into motion. So I think we're at a place right now where there is an acceleration of that. My My concern right now is it seems as though, there is sort of like a secret Yalta or Congress of Vienna type of operation that has been like there's an underdefined operating system that's going to replace the currently collapsing time bomb that was once an economy, but I mean our economy has become a time bomb that has been detonated to collapse. It can't be saved. There will be a new system, and I think there's a fight over like what will be the characteristics of that new system. There's or who will it serve, and so I get the sense that there has been a embrace of, or we're sort of at that transitionary period, like the Rome was with maybe the death of Julius Caesar and the onset of a new set of civil wars that pulled Rome into, was it 15 years of civil war, out of which that pulverized society would be more susceptible to accepting something unacceptable to the former society pre-Caesar that still had certain aspirations of republican values to hold on to. And after that bloodbath, people were much more pliable. And the idea of, Emperor Octavian, Augustus Octavio, or Octavio Augustus, who was itself, it seems from my research, cut a deal with certain high priests from the cult of Mithra on the Isle of Capri to establish Rome instead of Alexandria as the new capital of this new type of society, which is, pretty much good old Babylon, but with a bit more projective power in the form of the empire, with a new, more sanctified set of active priests, like cults, these, Isis and Cybele Attis and Mithra, which had formerly not been in as governing of a role as they were after this point. They became more of a top-down managerial thing within the new system of controlling the Pantheon and its Roman variations of this occult system. So my concern right now is that we're sort of at one of these types of millennial shifting points, and I don't see nearly as much resistance to it as I was hoping there might be at this point. I'm hoping to God that, saner heads can prevail over the case in Iran, where I do think that the greater Israel ideologues are genuinely licking their lips to get that big trophy they've been aching for so many years, Iran, to be taken down so that they could eliminate whatever resistance is currently kind of making it annoying for Israel to just go full on with its massive accelerated expansion to establish greater Israel as pretty much occupying the borders. If you look at the maps that are acknowledged, as the covenant, the actualized covenant made by Moses and God, which involves pretty much the Neo-Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar. It's pretty much the exact same borders that they want to reestablish during those years that the Jews were in captivity in Babylon, except now under a new name. And I do think that, that a big part for me of the clues of how this is wired involves, Eichmann and Himmler's support both for the most radical Zionist faction. I mean, Eichmann taught himself Hebrew so that he could practice Kabbalah. And he said in an interview that, and I don't even think he was killed, though they say he was. But he said in an interview, if I had been a Jew, I would have been the most radical Zionist imaginable. I don't know how you could be anything other, which sounds a lot like Crowley saying, of course I believe in Darby and premillennial dispensationalism. I don't see how anybody could believe in any other thing. He just took on the role of the Antichrist. These same guys who are pushing Zionism in Nazi Germany are also at the same time pushing Haj Amin, the British, genocidalist who's overseeing and is craving the total destruction of the Jews, and frankly is more than willing to kill most of his own Muslim people at the same time, who's working with Hitler and getting support to create this pro-Nazi Arab army. So I think it's part of the ritual is just get, create a situation whereby the Arabs and the Jews living in that region pretty much annihilate each other and reinstate the Kingdom of Jerusalem under a technocratic sort of or a transhuman sort of new rebranding of the same old. That's unfortunately how I see the orientation, and I hope that I could be proven wrong. But that's the trend.
Yeah, Okay, thanks, Matt. David, what do you make of the I mean, for me, it's so weird looking at this from a journalistic point of view to see, well, we could see the opening shots of World War III tonight, and then you wake up in the morning and Donald Trump has decided no.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I never know what's going on short term. I don't think we can. We know what their goals are long term. It's short term that's the struggle to figure out. But I think back to your point that you made, Matt, about Palantir being funded by Intutel, which was a CIA front. And so what's curious is that it was Palantir. So when Cambridge Analytica wanted to breach basically steal all the Facebook profiles, it was Palantir who showed them how to do it. But of course, Peter Thiel was also was the earliest funder of Facebook in the first place. And so that was all part of a This is what I detail in my book, Corridor Optical, was a part of a pretty elaborate operation. It was publicized as a Russian operation, but it was really an Israeli operation to use Russian hackers, use the Russian mafia, which is a Jewish mafia, which used Russian hackers to create or to accelerate memes produced by Discordian pranksters to divide and conquer the United States and create mobilize support for Donald Trump, which it seems to have worked. The architect of that mission, I believe, was Alexander Dugin, and he is basically the modern leader. I'm suspecting of the Luciferian International, the modern leader of the Martinist tradition, who's out to create what he calls the empire of the end times, fulfilling the prophecy of Nostradamus, which aligns with the whole mythos of the Priory of Zion, which was inspired by the teachings of his two mentors, which were Raymond Abellio and Jean Parvulescu. To go on a bit of a tangent, Raymond Abellio was a friend of Antoine Pinay, who was the founder of two key organizations. One of them was the Bilderberg conferences, and then a year apart, he founded the Pinay Circle, which became the umbrella of the Fascist International. And this is where how with branches in South America, South Africa, which is how I believe Peter Thiel and his network is implicated. So, this and the Fascist International was behind the Gladio operation. It was working closely with rogue agents of the CIA, particularly Ted Shackley's secret team, who had been involved in the JFK assassination, then moved on to the Golden Triangle heroin trade in Southeast Asia. Then they moved on to Iran-Contra. And it's largely most of the felons of the Iran-Contra linked closely with the neoconservatives, which has basically been the architects of the foreign policy in the last couple of decades. And this all goes back to a conference organized by Netanyahu in 1979, known as the Jerusalem Conference, when he effectively dictated to this entire network of the Circle and neoconservatives that the new enemy was going to be terrorism. And that's how the invasion and support of the so-called jihad in Afghanistan was justified, and of course, leading all the way up to 9/11. And that, in sum, is pretty much the history that we've been living. So, effectively, it's coming back to the whole idea of the protocols. The protocols were disseminated, popularized by a guy named Boris Brassall, who worked for William Wiseman, I think is what his name was, who was the head of British intelligence at the time, and was linked to the Kuhn Lode Bank. And the Kuhn Lode Bank is basically the network that connected the Warburgs and Jacob Schiff and that whole crowd, basically the earliest honest crowd. Of course, they were the fundies of the Nazis. And Boris Brassall, he was part of an organization called the Aufbau, which is active in Germany, consisting largely of white Russians. And they're the ones, this is the organization that introduced the Thule Society to the protocols, which is how Hitler and Alfred Rosenberg in particular was introduced to the protocols, and it became what Norm Cohn called it was a warrant for genocide. So it basically became a scheme to use this perception of a global communist and Jewish conspiracy to rally the Germans to oppose, you know, the Jews, which in this case, what they meant was not the Rothschilds and Warburgs that they were receiving funding from, but, you know, the poor shopkeepers and the ghetto Jews that the Zionists had traditionally been very much in opposition to, the Ostjuden, as they refer them to. And so Boris Brassel then comes to the United States, and he becomes the brain trust, as was referred to, of the America First Committee. Out of the America First Committee, you get the ASC, and then the American Security Council, and that's really the birth of the American right. The ASC teams up with the John Birch Society, with the Klan, and Ted Shackley's secret team to become the conspirators behind the assassination of JFK. And that's basically so this cabal that came over with Boris Brassel, this that developed through these committees, this is, they basically were underground for many, many decades. And you can see how much power they exercised, particularly at the Regnery family. But they never.
Which family? Which family?
Regnery. Regnery. They're still to this day the chief sponsors of the conservative movement. The Regnery Publishing is the main publishing arm for all these sort of right wing crackpots like Ann Coulter and this whole bunch, like David Horowitz. They're all published by Regnery. Regnery was also he also funded Richard B. Spencer to found, I can't remember what it was, but you know, Richard B. Spencer, the alt right guy. So they effectively funded the alt right as well. And so they had been struggling for many decades, all the way back to the 50s, trying to gain power in the United States. And the first person that they finally succeeded in doing so was Donald Trump. And they did so with the same MO as Hitler did, as basically pointing to a conspiracy that's rotting inside the government that needed to be overthrown. They used Trump as their mouthpiece to accomplish it, when in fact he's the agent of the deep state as opposed to its opponent.
Fascinating. And also, of course, I was entertained in a weird way watching all the court cases against Trump rumbling on in 2023 and 24, oh well, 22 and 23, where you could see that this was increasing his popularity. You know, any genuine opponent would be saying, well, let's just drop this, it's not working, you know. But no, the court cases had continued against Trump. And as did his popularity increase, it seems really obvious to me that, you know, he's been created as a sort of, you know, fake person who's against the deep state, you know, and he's got his own mind to a certain extent. But, you know, he's having his strings pulled. And also, of course, he's very wedded through Jared Kushner, etc., to the Zionist plans and, the greater Israeli expansion plans. So anyway, look. Thank you, guys. I think that's quite enough. I've kept you on the line for far too long. So maybe, Matt, you could just start by letting listeners know whereabouts they can find your work and follow you online, and maybe mention a couple of your books as well.
Yeah, sure. And thank you for pulling this together, Tony. And I had a great I can honestly say that I've never taken as many notes in one of these roundtable conversations as I have in today's session. David, we should meet up and have a beer. And I think it's over. Yeah, it's overdue, and we're like kind of close, so might as well just because there's so many things I'd want to have follow up questions for you on. And again, thank you for
I
giving
do as
me
well.
Tons of leads here to work on.
Great.
For people listening, if they want to look more into my work, my books, The Untold History of Canada, The Clash of the Two Americas series, The Science Unshackled book, or The Revenge of the Mystery Cults, or my wife's books as well, On the Making of a World Religion, or The Black Sun, The Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set, that's all available on CanadianPatriot.org. Pretty easy to find, along with regular updates and our documentaries that we're doing, including exposing the Rosicrucian hands behind the UFO PSYOP that's accelerating now. All of that stuff is mostly available for free to watch. And my Substack, I put out stuff almost every day, mostly free. That's MatthewArrett.substack.com.
And David?
Thanks, Tony. So my website is ortoabcal.ca. So that's where it's basically the sort of the main hub where I keep all the information about myself and my research. You can find links to all my books there. Three of them are on the site itself as web pages. So that's Ordo Ab Cal, the Zionism book, and my most recent Divide and Conquer. I don't do Facebook anymore. I don't do any other social media. I only do Patreon. So I welcome anyone who's interested to join me there. That's where I share some of my recent findings, my observations on what is happening, and things like that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, your Dying God is, I think, really fascinating. For me, it did something which no book has ever done, David, which is to carry this right the way back thousands of years to start to look at, actually, maybe Margaret Murray did a similar thing, to look at some of the roots of today's problems in thousands of years ago. But anyway, both of you, thanks very much for joining us.
Excellent.
Thank
Thanks again for putting together, and great to meet you and talk with you, Matt.
you. All right, likewise.